does seem that no matter how much damage we do to the land, defoliating it, building on it, poisoning it, nature rebounds after humans leave. That's the subject of Cal Flynn's latest book, Islands of Abandonment, Life in a Post-Human Landscape, in which she travels to a dozen such places. Chernobyl, for example, the buffer zone between the Republic of Cyprus and the Turkish-claimed part of the island, Detroit, and writes lyrically about the ecology and the psychology of abandoned places. Cal Flynn says that we are in the midst of a huge self-directed experiment in rewilding. She lives in Orkney, the archipelago of islands off the northeast coast of Scotland. She's with us from Stromness. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Any signs of trees returning to Orkney?
Well, I think perhaps not in the near future, but maybe if the climate is warming, you never know.
You never do know. You talk about an island near Orkney called Swona, where unusually in the case studies that you have in your book, people chose to leave. And let's start here because it's close to where you are. They just let their cows out before they left in 1974. And you went there and found what?
Well, I found a very eerie abandoned island. It's quite a small island of four or five houses now standing in sort of various states of dereliction. And the cattle have been living there ever since. So now I think there's been around 10 generations of cattle, and they behave very much like wild animals now. So they live as a feral herd, actually quite unusual. There's a very small number of feral herds in the world. So they live entirely unmanaged, and they tend to move around in a big pack. But when there are more males of sort of sexual age, they fight, and sometimes they exile the males to small headland at the north of the island. So they behave a lot more like the way you might imagine wild horses or wild deer to behave. And they're very wary of humans. So I was warned to give them, you know, a lot of space in the island because they can charge if they feel at all threatened.
So they rewilded.
Yes, to an extent. I mean, certainly in behaviour. One reason I was interested in these cattle is I was sort of interested in when a domestic species becomes wild again. You know, when do they stop being feral and when do they start being truly wild? You know, how many generations have to pass? How much evolution has to pass to sort of undo those 10,000 years of history with humans breeding them? Yes, they're wild in my eyes, and I was interested, I suppose, in the definition of wild.
One of the most fascinating, they're all fascinating, but one of the most fascinating chapters looks at the Salton Sea in California. It's a chapter called The Deluge in the Desert. And this sounds completely horrible. It was an inland sea that was formed by the flooding of a river, and ever since it's been kind of dying and stinking, and people who once thought that it would be a fabulous holiday resort have long gone. And now it's home to a whole lot of people who've run out of other places to go, suffice it to say. Are you suggesting that that's a form of rewilding?
I think for the Salton Sea, what I saw was almost a rewilding of the human soul. You know, to me, especially, I think you're alluding towards Slab City, which is this sort of anarchic community which has grown up on this abandoned army base near the Salton Sea. And it really is, I mean, if you've seen the film Mad Max, it's got that aesthetic. And you really feel that people are sort of living quite rawly, living quite on the edge. And I was just fascinated by the way that community has sprung up and how it has its own sense of morals and how they build their houses and art and all sorts of things out of the rubbish of, you know, the rest of society. You know, they sort of scavenge for tires or bits of wood and they build them up into these big houses and they make amazing sculptures. out of, you know, real trash. And I suppose to me that was almost like a vision of some kind of post-apocalyptic future of how people behave when we don't have the normal strictures of society. I found it really a fascinating place to visit. Also quite a frightening one. You know, I spent a couple of nights there and, you know, at night in the middle of the desert, and you have people wandering around and shouting, and they do, you know, inarguably have a drug problem there, and you don't feel safe exactly. You have to be very much looking after yourself. And it did have that sort of dystopian feel that I was looking for when I went there, and I certainly found it in Slab City. It really opened my eyes, I think, to the possibilities of how we can live, and also the dangers of why we might not want to live like that.
I just want to read a wee bit of your description in that chapter of the Salton Sea, because it gives an idea of what kind of writing you use, and it's very beautiful. Here on the shores of the dying sea, where fish swim drunkenly in anoxic waters, gasping for breath, where the bones of their dead crumble into dust underfoot, such knowledge washes over one in a wave of regret and recrimination. The knowledge of the increasing CO2 levels in the atmosphere. It is hard not to see this place, this Medean landscape, as a portent, a vision of the future, or a warning of what more is to come, an augury of the end of the world, the dawning of the age of dust. Now, that came as a shock to me, because this comes towards the end of the book, and your previous chapters about nature reclaiming places that we've stuffed up, basically, was quite optimistic. But you've slammed me with the Salton Sea, and now I'm depressed again.
Yes, it's, I suppose there's a point, two points here. I think one of them was tempering that sense of, not optimism, because I do think we should be optimistic and we should certainly hold hope. But we also, I think, have to be very aware of the danger that we're facing. You know, if climate change does charge ahead at current rates, it could be moving too fast for things to adapt. And so I talk a lot in the book about the way that nature adapts, rebounds, recovers, regenerates, and, you know, rapid evolution. There can be a time when things can change too fast, when it can be too disastrous. And so we have to be aware of that, I think. And so I guess I'm sort of tempering myself and not letting my enthusiasm get too far ahead of me. At the same time, the second point I wanted to make was that even if humans don't survive, there is a possibility that the world will go on without us, and that other species will be able to adapt and come to the fore. And that, you know, that's happened many times in the past following mass extinctions. And, you know, this might be the end of the age of man, should we allow it to be. But that does not mean the end of the world, but we won't be there to see it. And I suppose to me, that's a sort of strangely, frighteningly, you know, terrifyingly beautiful thought. And I thought I would put it down and share it with people, you know, that idea that other things might recover after us, but we might not be able to see it.
You visit some really toxic places, Place Agaz near Verdun, where millions of unused shells and gas canisters were burned after World War One, and the soil's full of arsenic and poisons. But in the Zone Rouge, you found these plants which can absorb toxins and continue to survive.
Yes, that's right. And I'm really fascinated by these plants. And you get plants and various species that sort of survive in these very unlikely circumstances. The ones that I look at there are called metallophytes, metal-loving plants. And some of them are something called metal accumulators, which means that they actually sort of suck it up from the ground. They almost purify the earth around them, and then they store it in their bodies. Nobody really understands why they do that. But it opens, you know, the possibility for this really interesting way forward for really damaged environments, contaminated land, for example, where there have been mine tailings or that kind of thing, where you might plant, you know, a crop of sunflowers, for example. They're very good at sort of sucking up contaminants. And then you dry them, and then you can bake them and somehow, you know, harvest a crop of nickel or a crop of zinc. So I just think that that's really fascinating. And just, Yes, that sense that one creature's poison is another creature's mana was something that I found to be very powerful and thought-provoking. And I come back to that idea again and again, but specifically in that chapter, we talk about the heavy metals and how some things sort of thrive there. And also again in Salt and Sea, as we talked there about how you have something called halophytes or halophytic bacteria, which they bloom or come to life at different solutions of salt in water, and so water will change color as it evaporates, and it becomes more and more salty because different species are blooming and showing their colors. So yeah, I guess I wanted to underline that sense that we need to learn how to look at environments, and things that are damaged might come into being a good environment for different species. A whole new assemblage of species might come to the fore.
Your mention of maybe we could, plant metallophyte plants in areas that have become poisoned and thereby clean it up raises the question that is a certain theme of your book. How much do we try to restore landscapes that have been messed up, or do we just let them be? Because there is this dilemma when people want to restore them, it's another level of interference that may not be a good thing.
Yes, that's it. I mean, one thing that you sort of come across is this sense of restoration sometimes overstepping its mark, or we always have a certain philosophy of restoration as we go along, and restoration ecology is definitely a very rapidly growing field, and people are discovering things all the time. But when we look in the past of some efforts at restoration, for example, in Scotland, we had the case of what are called the West Lothian bings,
Yes.
which are spoil heaps, and they are gravel-like spoil heaps, very enormous, the size of hills. And there was a study of when a local ecologist, she compared some bings which had been quote unquote restored in the 70s and 80s, according to what was believed to be the right thing to do at the time, and those that had been left alone. And the ones that had been restored by having fertilizer applied and specific species added had actually done in the long run much worse, because the species that they'd been planted there hadn't been as well suited as the ones that just float in on the breeze and find a place to land, I suppose. And so it's just the idea of knowing when we should step back and admit that yes, we did the damage, but perhaps the most positive thing we could do at this stage is just allow sort of nature her head, as opposed to always, throwing open the bonnet and trying to fiddle around and trying to make it look like the way that we think the landscape should look, by planting things or yeah, that kind of thing. And I think it can be hard to know where that line is, because certainly I don't want to write a permission note for people to just pollute any landscape they want, but I also think that we need to learn when perhaps we're overstepping our bounds, and the best thing would be to admit defeat and to step away and come
Oh,
back in 50 years and see what happens.
you realize you're talking to a country where we are engaged in a constant battle to control or eradicate foreign species. Your view seems to be that, at least based on the examples you write about and what you've just said, we in New Zealand should step back and let whatever happens happen, too late to stop.
Actually, New Zealand is such an interesting example, because I think the whole world is sort of looking at New Zealand to see, how well you do and how possible it is to contain things. I'm on Orkney and we have a problem of invasive stoats, and there's a big project at the moment to eradicate them here, and it's proving very difficult. And so everyone's looking at New Zealand because you're really at the top of the game, And I think that's really interesting, because many, can this be done on a large enough scale, and what's the trade-off? What's the damage that's done to allow that to happen? I don't think that I have all the answers to that, and certainly I am reading all about this, and I'm really interested to see what happens in New Zealand, and I think all the expertise that comes from that is really going to feed into, restoration ecology, but also into how the rest of the world knows how to react to invasive species generally, because I talk about the idea of novel ecosystems in the Tanzania chapter. And this is a really, you know, controversial idea of, you know, when do you just admit defeat and allow things to mix? And, you know, it's actually hard to know when the answer is. And if you're on a big island, you are probably in a good position to see if you can eradicate. I guess we'll just have to see how you get on.
Yes. We're not, yeah, stoats. Mm-mm. Stoats are hard to love, suffice it to say, aren't they? You're referring to the Amani Nature Reserve in Tanzania, where back in the early 1900s, German scientists created an experimental arboretum, and then it became abandoned when independence happened, presumably, and native species have begun reclaiming the land after being clear cut. And the suggestion maybe is that we could all sit on our hands here and hope that new ecosystems evolve and over time stabilize into something that doesn't need the hand of humans constantly to press upon it. But Tanzania might be a little different from New Zealand, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the similarity there is, you know, that it's a very rare, the assemblage of species that you find in the cloud forests in Tanzania are very unusual. There's a high number of endemic species, the way that in New Zealand you have your own species that you want to protect. And so there's a lot to lose, I think, from invasive species getting a hold in. And the problem in Tanzania, in Amani, is that the arboretum and the botanical gardens were left for so long that really a lot of these species are naturalizing and spreading. And I think it might be beyond, I suppose, you know, what is the damage going to be if you start going into the rainforest, and which is otherwise fairly untouched in large parts, and start cutting down huge amounts, so, you know, swathes of the trees, you know, what damage will that do? And it is a little bit of an unknown question. You know, novel ecosystems as a concept is very controversial, and I don't think anyone truly knows the answer. There's a lot of worry about, I suppose, the impurity of these forests that were otherwise, you know, fairly untouched. But there was a huge amount of worry about a particular species of tree that was thought to be, you know, taking over this pristine rainforest. And in that case, in Amani, the trees haven't spread as fast as it was feared. And so there's a great sense of relief, because I'm not sure that certainly there's the budget or the will to go and uproot or cut down all of those trees. So that's fortunate. And a local fungus is now attacking the sort of invasive tree that they were most worried about, the Mysopsis tree. So yeah, I think it's, you know, when it comes to conservation, the ethical questions are the ones that really fascinate me, because to begin with, when you first enter the field, you think that there will be one answer, and it's to be good, you know, and then the more you learn about it, the more you realize that nobody really knows for sure what the best course of action is. But often people really have very strong opinions that are in contradiction to each other. And I think that it's good to explore those options and to learn as much as possible and do as much as research as possible before we sort of race down doing like very interventionist methods. And, you know, taking action is one way that you get results.
Yes, we could talk more about the poisons that New Zealand uses to try to contain the invasive species. That's the most contentious issue here. But I wanted to talk about the idea that humans are bad and nature is good, and we need to just get out of the way, because this is the tone of some of the texts I'm getting from listeners. But that's not really what you're saying, is it?
No, I don't think so. I think what I'm saying is that we need to learn, I don't know, I suppose to respect nature and not to constantly be imposing our will on it. You know, like it, so often when we step into managing an environment, we have an idea of what we would like it to look like at the end of our intervention, and we have goals for it, you know, and that's not necessarily what the species within that environment might be working towards. So I think.
You talk about the opportunity that's presented to us now. Rewilding is taking place in many countries as a result, not deliberately, but as a result of falling populations, people moving to cities, intensive farming, which has reduced the spatial footprint of farming, if not the environmental footprint of it. And in Japan, there are ghost homes, and in Spain, the population is expected to fall by what, over 50% by 2100. And the acres of Soviet farmland, now abandoned since the end of communism, we're looking at by default rewilding in many parts of the world, right?
Yes, and I think that these are kind of quite. I'm very interested in these cases in particular because it's not a decision that we've made, right? We have decided. When I say we, I suppose I'm sort of speaking collectively about people, but the populations of those areas have left of their own accord. So it's not what I'm very against is this kind of top-down forcing of people out of areas. I would never. Would never argue for that, you know, coming from the Highlands, and we had the Highland Clearances, which has had a great shadow over a long period. So I don't think it's about feeling that humans are bad and therefore we should leave, but once we leave to see what has been gained and to protect what springs up in our absence, you know, in these examples, especially where there are falling populations, increasingly urbanized populations, you have a lot of what we'd call marginal farmland, which is the farmland that's most difficult to farm, fall abandoned, I suppose, of their own accord. And I think that's really interesting.
Oops.
Step away, it leaves a kind of vacuum into which nature expands and different species might come to the fore then. So yeah, I'm completely fascinated by that. And you know, the global population is forecast to peak sometime next century, depending on what estimates and papers you look at. So we could be looking at a much more empty world in a century or 2 centuries.
Yes, that's not what was predicted, of course, is it?
No, I mean we're seeing big demographic changes that was not predicted at all. So I think that there was a great sort of moral panic a couple of decades ago about how the population of the earth was exploding. And that's actually not coming to pass. Certainly we're seeing in the developed world and also in sort of middle income countries that fewer and fewer babies are being born. And that pattern seems to be sort of working its way through to lower income countries as well. So it does look like we are going to peak, and that, well, possibly humanity begins to dip. You know, we have smaller numbers of people on the earth, and then possibly taking up a lot less space, you know, as we're living in cities and farming more intensively. So I think it's very difficult to predict with any sense of certainty when it comes to that, but it's definitely something we should be aware of.
Very good to talk to you. Thank you. Carol Flynn, whose book's called Islands of Abandonment, Life in the Post-Human Landscape. It's very beautiful, very beautifully written. And she says we need to reset our ideas of what beauty is. A number of you have pointed out that we've watched the native bush slowly reclaim the Rimutaka Hills from the gorse over the last 40 years. It used to be covered in dark vegetation with yellow flowers, but now the natives have grown through and smothered the gorse. Yes, that's an interesting finding. People used to want to eradicate and poison the gorse, but it turns out that it can be quite useful.